The Elk Talk podcast is brought to you by the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, ensuring the future of elk, other wildlife, their habitat, and our hunting heritage. To become a member, go to rmef.org.
Welcome to the Elk Talk podcast with Randy Newberg and Corey Jacobson, presented by the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation.
The goal is, what little you and I know about elk hunting, we share with people.
I've got an elk building that's like 120 yards away. What do I do? First off, the thought would never cross my mind when an elk's being 120 yards away to call anybody on a cell phone.
All elk?
All the time. Only elk?
Only elk.
Well, it's us having conversations, so we usually go down some rabbit holes. But
if you hunt with Corey Jacobson, you will find the landscape is full of rabbit holes. We're just going to make this up as we go.
And you look at it like, oh, that's a target-rich environment. But if you're trying to single one out, a solo target there is much easier to go into than a big group.
We record everything, so there's no BS and no lying, no faking it with us.
Did we hit the record button?
I forgot to hit the record button. If you want to know something about elk hunting, this probably isn't the podcast to listen to. Should we give them a list of all the other podcasts where they might learn something?
Happy Veterans Day, Corey.
Hey, happy Veterans Day.
Yeah, to all those who are veterans and have given so much, our greatest gratitude and thank you.
Absolutely.
It's almost like thank you isn't adequate.
It's not.
I
think that's good, because I think it leaves us knowing that we're living in debt to them, and thank you's never enough. So every day we've got to wake up and remember.
You said it's snowing in Idaho today. What's up with that? There wasn't even any frost on my windshield here in Montana this morning.
Wow. Yeah, it's snowing here. We've had some wacky weather, but it's starting to get consistent. Our hunt that we went on, which we'll talk more about, I'm sure, but our first night there got down to 5 degrees, and we backpacked in, and so that was my first foray of backpacking in 5 to 6 miles and then sleeping on the ground in 5 degree weather. But I had some amenities that made it pleasant. But we were hiking in about 16 inches of snow on that hunt.
And, whoa!
It's like real.
There is no snow on the ground in Montana. It is like
we have just a skiff of snow at our house. You know, it snowed just a little bit this morning, but you can see good snow on the mountains all around us.
Yeah, I mean, you get up high, there's some snow, but this is one of the warmest hunting seasons I remember in a long time.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, the rivers this time of year are usually partially froze, or at least have that pancake ice floating down.
Yeah.
But next week, I'm thinking I'm just going to take my jet boat out and go fishing in the river and float down and wait for a whitetail or a duck to come by or something.
The ducks haven't even started flying there yet, huh?
No, hardly. Yeah. I mean, actually, there are a ton of ducks in this valley because there's a lot of agriculture, and they're all in private, so it doesn't do me any good. But when we have warm years like this, the number of ducks that accumulate in this valley is crazy. And then the first 10 inches of snow we get, and they can't get down to all that grain stubble or grain waste, then they're out of here. But oh, well. But this is about elk hunt, not duck hunt.
That's right. Thank goodness. I think I've shared my I don't want to say disappointment, but my differing opinions of what to do during September. My youngest son, Sam, has found that duck season opens during September for youth in Idaho, and he's actually chosen to go duck hunting over elk hunting a few times.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I still
love him, but, you know.
My son Matthew, if you told him he could shoot a 340-inch bull elk in the parking lot, or he could shoot one mallard by hiking over the Bridger Mountains, he'd have his shotgun on his shoulder and he'd be heading over the Bridger Mountains. I mean, the guy, when it comes to waterfowl hunting, I think last year he told me he waterfowl hunted like 28 or 30 days. Oh. And I think he elk hunted 4 days, maybe. It's
like, oh, well, wow. I mean, you have to get in 30 days of waterfowl hunting just to equal 1 day of elk hunting.
Well, there you go. Now you got all those waterfowl hunters mad at us. But what the heck?
Well, this is an Elk Talk podcast. So.
Yeah. It's talking about people being mad. So I come home from Colorado on Sunday and my wife gives me the hug. You know, she hadn't seen me for a couple of weeks and everything. And then I come in the house and I drop my bags and she kind of has this, "Hey, Mr. Marriage Expert, I got a question for you."
Somebody, I warned you.
Somebody in our audience knows my wife.
Oh no.
And ratted me out.
Yep.
She's never listened to this podcast. Uh-huh. Never in our whatever 6 years of doing this. She has never listened to an episode.
I told so you when you talk about marriage advice. If you want your wife to listen to something you say and to listen closely, you just tell her you're going to give some marriage advice. And I guarantee you she will listen to every word. Not because she wants to learn, but because she knows you don't have a clue what you're talking about.
Right. So, needless to say, I'm still married.
Yeah, that's good.
She's like, "You know, you sure think you know a lot about how women think." I'm like, "No, if you listen to that, honey, I was talking about how young men think." This was premarital advice, most of it.
I'm pretty sure you said the best marital advice you can give is premarital advice.
Right. Yeah. So.
So do you have heat out in your shop?
Yeah, I do. I have a big blast furnace out in my shop.
That's good. But, so you're staying warm at night at least.
Well, it was kind of weird because she said I bought some tickets to go hang out with my mom and my sister in Oregon. So I was home for like 2 days and she's gone. Like, okay, I can take a hint. So what do you say, man? It's like, "Well, honey, you know, was I wrong?" And she's like, "Well, you just think you know more than you do." Like, well, compared to what I knew when I was 24 and getting into this arrangement, I'm highly trained now. She's like, "Oh, yeah, you're
highly trained, but that does not mean you know anymore."
Yeah, maybe I should have a t-shirt. Don't mistake good training with intelligence.
That's right.
So we had a good laugh about it. She's a good sport. She always says, "I wish you'd put a disclaimer out there when you start giving this marriage advice, because someone's going to follow it and it's going to be a train wreck for them and they're going to sue you." I'm like, "What are they going to sue me for? I didn't charge them anything." Yeah. So
I walked out. We have a home gym in our garage, and my wife, I may have even been a year or more ago, I walked out there and I could hear your voice coming through the speakers. And I thought, what is going on? And I realized she listens to the Elk Talk podcast while she's working out. And I'm sure she's not listening to learn to be a better elk hunter. She's listening to make sure that I don't say anything that I shouldn't. So I learned at that point that any marriage advice that I give is going to be advice that I've received directly from her and not advice that I make up on my own.
Yeah. So I told my wife many times when she gets on me about my marriage advice stuff, she's like, "Well, you can't say this. You can't, people should really know what I think about it." I'm like, "That's why I keep asking you to be on the podcast." And she's like, I'm not going to be on that podcast.
Yeah.
I'm like, "Well, you know, kind of like the old saying that if you don't get it on video, it didn't really happen." And, so honey, if you don't get on the podcast and say it, guess what? it's not fact. It's not true. So I think Kim and Jennifer need to have their own podcast. We need to hand the mic over to them one time.
Oh, man. Everything that we have.
We'd never be elk hunting ever again.
Oh, man.
We might be elk hunting, but we wouldn't have an audience that puts any credibility into anything we say.
I'm surprised we do anyway, but yeah, that would solidify it.
Yeah. So anyhow, that was interesting. When we went to Colorado, Matthew, my son, had a deer tag for the second rifle season, and I had that tag 20 years ago. Same unit, same season dates, everything. And when I went there, I saw a bull elk, a legal bull, every day that I could have shot.
Wow.
So
that was 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I'm all excited. It's like, well, one of us should buy an elk tag, but let's shoot the deer first, and then we'll worry about the elk. Well, it's a good thing, because I did not see an elk. I didn't see a cow. I didn't see a bull. I didn't see a spike. I didn't see anything in our 5 days there. So, but Marcus found a really, really big, for an over-the-counter unit, it's probably a 310-inch, 6-point deadhead.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah, we're glassing for deer, and he's a fanatic like you are about.
Glassing for deer.
No, and so he hiked over there. It was a long hike. I'm like, well, it's the heat of the day, you know. You may as well trek on over there and pick it up. And so he just took off, no pack, no anything. He gets over there, and the thing is still got a lot of that leather, you know, how when they die. And I'm giving narration. I'm watching him over there, and he's trying to disconnect the leather that's still attached to the head, to the neck, and the under part of the body. And I'm giving narration. Oh, Marcus is going Neanderthal here. He's got a sharp rock, and he's dragging that carcass around, pushing on that sharp rock to try cut the leather. And he was over there for the longest time. Finally, he comes back, and he's just sweating. He's like, I didn't bring a knife. You know how hard it is to cut the leather on an elk's neck with a sharp rock? I'm like, no, man, I called that one.
It's hard to cut that skin when it's fresh with a sharp knife, let alone when it leatherifies.
Yeah. But what he should have done is taken my little saw over there. Because when we got back to camp, he just sawed the antlers off the pedicles anyhow. I'm like, well, why didn't you take the saw? Then you wouldn't have had to. But it was impressive. You guys who collect elk antlers are a different, you guys are cut from a different cloth.
I've come to realize that.
I think if there would have been a 200-inch mule deer standing there, I don't think Marcus would have traversed that landscape as fast as he did to go pick up a deadhead.
Yeah.
And where that thing was located in that canyon, I wasn't going to walk over that far. I don't care if it was a 400-inch deadhead. I wasn't going over there. I did find a deadhead mule deer.
Did you?
And then I hung it in a tree. And the next sometime the next day, Matthew shot a nice buck. It works every time.
I thought you were gonna say sometime the next day those antlers appeared in our camp and Marcus had found a deadhead in a tree.
No, my crew knows, as you've seen when you've been with us, that they're under strict orders that if you pull antlers that I hang in a tree, if you pull them out of there, there's consequences.
The Elk Talk podcast has been sponsored from the beginning by our friends at Go Hunt. And you may think of them about draw odds and all the other information that we use and we talk about. But the one thing a lot of people don't know is they have the best Western hunter gear shop anywhere. So if you're interested and you're buying gear and you want to get a discount on regular priced items out on their gear shop, go out to gohunt.com and go to the shop. And when you do, use promo code ELKTALK when you check out, and you're going to save quite a bit of money on all those regular priced items.
The Elk Talk podcast is also brought to you by Mountain Ops, making outdoor energy and performance nutrition to make you a stronger and healthier elk hunter. They have a full line of hunting-related supplements, including meal replacement shakes, multivitamins, pre-workout fuel, and post-workout recovery, and my favorite, their new performance protein bars that, by the way, are packed with 270 calories and 20 grams of protein, but contain less than 6 grams of sugar. Visit mountainops.com to learn more and to order, and be sure to use the promo code ELKTALK to save on your next order.
Elk Talk Podcast is also brought to you by the University of Elk Hunting. The University of Elk Hunting was founded by Corey Jacobson. It is now part of the suite of courses out there at OutdoorClass.com. So if you want to sign up for the University of Elk Hunting and save some money, go out to OutdoorClass.com and use Elk Talk as your promo code, and you'll get 20% off. But more importantly, you're going to get the University of Elk Hunting. You're going to get other courses from Outdoor Class taught by Corey Jacobson, Remy Warren, Randy Newberg, John Barklow, Hank Shaw, Jamie Teagan, and on and on and on. There you have it. OutdoorClass.com will get you the University of Elk Hunting. Just make sure you use promo code ELKTALK and save 20%.
It was a lot of fun. Been trekking and traversing, but I haven't had to deal with any 5-degree weather.
No. I don't know if I'm supposed to say anything, so I better
keep we'll it. Say it then.
I'll keep it vague, but okay. I had a prototype stove, titanium stove, that I was able to take with me. And it's my first time that I've actually packed a stove and a teepee, with the exception of when we went to Alaska and I was never able to get a fire going. This time I knew I'd be able to get a fire going because we were in Idaho and there's dry wood in Idaho. So I packed a titanium stove and a teepee with me, and it was incredible. Like, you could lay there in the teepee on one side and have a bunch of firewood on the other side and all your gear and get this little fire just roaring in there. And, you know, I didn't keep it going all night, but man, it was sure nice to get back and have a fire to get your gear all sorted out and dry out, and then to, you know, fire going while you climb in the sleeping bag, and then you let the fire go out. And the next morning I could roll over in my sleeping bag without getting out of the sleeping bag, still on my sleeping pad, and put a fire in that stove and get it going and lay there for about 15 minutes and let it get nice and warm, and then get out and get dressed and get ready to go. And mm-hmm. it was awesome. Even in 5-degree weather, me, who gets cold when it's usually, you know, under 52 degrees, I was playing comfortable the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That's different than how I do things. First of all, if the forecast is 5 degrees, I don't do anything but a wall tent with a big stove and a couple cords of firewood. And it's hard to backpack with a wall tent. You ever try to put a wall tent in your pack?
Nope, but I've put one on a llama once and thought, I'm glad the llama's carrying it and not me.
Yeah. Yeah, those little wall tents that Bo makes, or, you know, that he sells, they fit perfectly in one pannier.
Yeah.
So the bigger question is, did you get an elk? Did you have to pack an elk up?
So I went scouting the week before. Just because mm-hmm. I knew, well, Isaac and I actually rode motorcycles into the area, you know, within 8 miles of where we wanted to go. And I realized this isn't a motorcycle ride for hunting. It's, you know, it's a technical trail. And once there's snow on the trail, it becomes pretty much impossible to motorcycle on. So I hiked into the area about 5 days before we went in there. And it was an absolute nightmare. I've never seen so many blowdowns. Like, it was a tangled matchbox of blowdown, just horrible. But I did find one saddle that we could go up kind of an open ridge and pass through that saddle and then drop down into the canyon on the next side. And I thought, that's going to be our path. So we did it. There was snow now on the ground, which when I scouted it, there wasn't. So every one of these blowdowns now was covered in snow and about 10 times as slippery. And it took us 7 hours and 55 minutes to go in 5.1 miles.
Whoa.
Never hiked that slowly before. And it was just a matter of, you know, we had about a 1,000-foot climb and then a 1,000-foot descent and then another 1,000-foot climb, just going over ridges to get back in there. over that 5.1 miles, but we made it, and we actually bumped elk from the point that we put our camp on, so we were right in the middle of the elk, which, you know, in archery season, I wouldn't get that close. In rifle season, I thought all they're going to do is move over to the open hillside across from us, which is perfect, and they did. The problem is there were only about three openings in the entire unit that we could actually see to shoot on.
Yeah.
All three of them were 1,000 to 1,200 yards away, so too far to shoot and very hard to get into gun range of those openings. The next day we did, I don't remember, it was 5 or 6 miles that we hiked, and it took 9 hours. That was hunting without camp on our back, so just a day pack. It was just such slow going, just solid brush, blowdowns everywhere. And we got to the glassing point that I had identified, and that glassing point gave us a view of about 120 yards, and that was it. I literally walked to the glassing point, pulled up my binoculars, and looked down through the only opening I could see, and there were a herd of about 30 elk that came through there in a nice bull, not a big bull, but a, you know, small 6-point, and the cows were going crazy talking. And the bull let out one little bugle. And this was, you know, the last week of October. We stayed until November 1st. And he bugled, but never saw him again. And honestly, I wouldn't have shot him back in there, because we were a good 3 miles from camp and then another 5 miles from the truck. So it would have been an 8-mile pack. That probably would have taken 12 hours one way.
Yeah.
So didn't, you know, and we realized then that we can't shoot one any farther back in than we are from camp. I heard more bugling in 5 days in there than I probably heard in all of September.
We had
bulls bugling from camp every night, every morning. All I had to do was let out a cow call and bulls would light up across the canyon. But they were all raghorns and little bulls and cows. We probably saw 70 or 80 cows in there. We probably saw 10 different bulls. But the biggest bull I saw was maybe a like 270-inch type 6-point, and only saw him once. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, I don't want to give away everything. We did pack elk out. I still had my tag the last night we were there, and we listened to a bull bugle probably 50 or 60 times as we slipped in on him and got to within about 120 yards of him. Had wolves howling. There were wolves in there. We had them howling two different times from camp. But it wasn't fun. It wasn't a fun hunt. It was a tough hunt. I went in there hoping that we would be in the area where all the elk stack up from all the hunting pressure, because nobody else would be dumb enough to go in there. I got that part right. I figured it would be a place that big bulls would go as a sanctuary. I can't confirm that that was the case, because I didn't see a big bull, but I also don't think the big bulls would have been with the cows and the herd still. I think the young bulls were in thinking, oh, we caught the tail end of the rut. This is awesome. And they were still talking, but I think the big bulls had moved off by themselves and were just impossible to find, especially in that country.
Yeah. Dang. But you got to pack some elk out. So I know you live for that. So
yeah, that was, and it wasn't as bad as it could have been. It was in absolutely the best location for that area that we could have shot an elk in.
Okay.
So it wasn't an easy pack. You know, we had camps. We had to pack camp out first the first day. Then we had to go back in the second day without anything and pack elk meat out. And then we had to decide what to do with the rest of our hunt after that, whether to go back in or hunt from a base camp.
Hmm. Well, that's a heck of a deal.
Yeah. But you made a comment, I think it was in our last episode, that hunting a mature bull elk in the post-rut before they transition into late season habits is probably the hardest time frame to hunt an elk in. And I would agree. Like, it's the small bulls and the cows, every open hillside that we found, we could find those elk on. But I could not find a mature elk. And that was, you know, again, limited glassing, but we were glassing across the big canyon that had a lot of open hillsides. We saw cows. We saw a couple nice bulls, but not big bulls, and they weren't even huntable. I mean, there's no way we could have got to them and hunted them. But where we were hunting, it just, we couldn't, you know, going through the brush, the blowdowns, all the thick terrain in there, there's no way we could get close enough to shoot an elk, especially with 6 inches of crunchy snow on the ground. And then any opening that we saw, the big bulls just weren't in those openings, even at long distances, you know, glassing at first light and at last light, we still weren't picking out big bulls in any openings.
Well, I stand by that fact that the post-rut period that kind of runs till about November 1st, you know, plus or minus a few days, is the toughest time to kill an elk. And from that point forward, every day between now and whatever rifle seasons are still open, it gets easier and easier and easier.
Yeah. And I think there's a period at the beginning of the rifle seasons in most states. We waited until the very end, hoping we would catch, you know, the transition into the late season and catch those big bulls moving down to at least a transition point. Yeah. And I wish we'd have went opening day, because I guarantee you, based on what I saw in archery season, what I saw with the younger bulls, I guarantee that on October 15th, big bulls were still bugling in there. And I wish we would have went in there with a rifle the first part of the season when there was no snow, the weather was better, we wouldn't have had to pack as much camping gear, and the big bulls that are in there, I know they're in there. I think they'd have still been bugling. We had a chance to catch up to one.
Well, I noticed I didn't get an invite.
I totally invited you. And I told you, there's a lot of blowdown in there, and you're like, yeah, no thanks.
Yeah, I know. Because I, you know, in Colorado has all this beetle kill, right?
Yeah.
And that stuff started dying off 20 years ago, and now it's all blowing over. And in 2020, I think it was, I hunted an area that was just loaded with beetle kill, but there were a lot of elk in there, and they'd pick their little trails that you don't really know how they're navigating it, but somehow they do.
Yeah.
And I shot my bull about a little over a mile from our camp, and I went back and got the llamas. And to pick through all of that blowdown to bring that elk back to camp, we put on almost, I think, of just under 4 miles of zigzagging back and forth around this tree and up over this root ball. And it's like, this is a pain. This just sucks. And, you know, you think, well, I'm just going to straight line it through here. Well, if you have 60 pounds on your back, or a llama's got 100 pounds on its back, it's not going to do the steeplechase and hurdle all these blowdowns.
Yep.
So when you told me about blowdowns, my mind kind of flipped back to that Colorado hunt, and that's where I think I said thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's actually why I went in there scouting ahead of time, was to see if we could get llamas in there, because I had some llamas I'd reserved with Bo, and I thought, I better go in there and just make sure we can get llamas in there. And it was impossible. There was no way to get llamas into where we went. So I called him up and said, hey, we're not going to be able to take llamas in there.
Yeah. Well, what you found is a post-rut sanctuary, because most hunters are going to look at that and say, you know what? I don't need an elk that bad. I am not climbing and scrapping and stumbling through this mess.
Yeah.
Well, in a state with a lot of hunting pressure like Idaho, general seasons, kind of like Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, all four of those states, even in some parts of Oregon, those bulls know year after year, guess what? Not a lot of people are either foolish enough or stout enough to stumble in here.
Yep.
And so they go hang out in there, and the odds are there were some of those bigger bulls in there, but they're not the ones bugling. Yeah, they're not the ones snorting and acting like, you know, it's still the peak rut.
Yep.
Those are the 2.5, maybe some 3.5-year-olds that are doing that foolishness.
That's exactly what we saw. Yep, there was nothing. They were all 2.5-year-old raghorns, 3.5-year-old 5 points, and then that one, I saw two bulls that were 6 points, both smaller 6 points, but they were, you know, it was funny because the one, there was a saddle we could see from camp. We just glassed right from our camp, and it was about 1,200 yards across to this saddle. And every single evening, the cows would pour through that saddle. And the first night, I think there were 7 bulls that came through there with the cows. And again, spikes, raghorns, just little stuff. And I think it was on the second or the third evening, I saw this nicer bull, which, you know, looking back now, I probably should have got more excited and tried to get over there and find a place to get a shot, because, you know, I really was thinking we would see at least 1 or 2 big bulls. But we saw him. He came out to the edge of the opening in the saddle, stood and watched all the cows file through, and then he turned and walked up the ridge in the trees, and we never saw him again. Like, he did not come through that one little opening. He stood on the edge of it, watched all the cows go through it, and then he turned and walked around. He just wouldn't step into the opening. He wasn't a big bull. So, you know, those big bulls that time of year, they've recognized that, hey, somebody steps into an opening, they next time we see them, they're getting a ride in little white bags, and it doesn't look pleasant. So I'm not going to step in that opening. And they just, those big bulls get so smart that time of year that if they aren't bugling and you aren't in an area where you can glass and find them, they're impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of, you're past the point where they're active and calling and pushing cows, but you're not yet to that point where the daylight's getting shorter, the temperatures are getting colder, the snow is getting deeper, and they have to come out. Just you start getting into this time in November, they need to at least maintain the what little fat they have left. They're not going to get fat on the forage that's out there right now, but if they can at least keep an even keel, so they're out more in the morning and they come out earlier in the afternoon, and they will, now they're in groups of, you know, 4 to 8, 3 to 8, whatever. So they're more visible. They're having to feed more. So that's why it starts getting easier as you get into November. That, I mean, you look at the number of emails we've got in the last couple of weeks about guys who hunted that last 2 weeks of October and what a challenge it was for
them.
Didn't
see any elk. And how do you find elk? Because the tracks we saw were all going to private, and we didn't see anything on public. And, well, there's the sanctuary.
Yeah. So did you see that picture I sent you?
I did get a screenshot of it almost reminded me of like an old calendar photo from the 1980s. You know, you got the one where the guy's kind of squatted down next to a tree and his rifle's just out of reach, and there's a bull elk standing there looking at him. And it wasn't quite like that, but there was something going on in the picture that we probably need a story for.
Yeah, there was me and a 5-point bull elk and my rifle being drawn down on that bull elk, and it was on public land, and it was opening day of elk season in Montana.
And you still have your elk tag with you as we speak, right?
I still have my elk tag with me.
So there's a story here about why Randy didn't shoot a bull elk on opening day when he had the rifle to his shoulder and the bull elk standing in front of him.
Yeah. I'm a man of my word. If I tell you this is how it's going to be, that's how it's going to be. So my unnamed camera guy who it wasn't Michael or Marcus.
Well, those are the two that I would like to give a hard time to. So
okay. So anyhow, this camera guy is one of the nicest guys you'd ever meet. And when I told him, hey, Gerber's coming to town, we're going in a couple days early with all these llamas, you know, going 5-6 miles in, he went in and scouted while we were up in Canada. He went in and scouted for the camp location and everything. And I'm like, dang, thanks for doing that. You get first shot if a legal bull comes by. He's like, oh, cool. All right. So Gerber comes with all this prototype gear that we're working on and that we're doing video, and they brought a videographer and a camera guy and their director creative director. So it's 3 of them and me and my camera guy, and none of the Gerber guys have tags. They just want to come along and get authentic camp shots and all this stuff. And so, but they want to tag along for the hunt part of it.
Yeah.
And so I thank God we had six llamas, because I carried enough food to feed a lot of people. And we got in 2 days before season. I cooked a big dinner that night. We went and scouted the next day, and down on private, there are just elk everywhere. But all the herds of cows had either raghorns or five points with them. There was I bet you we saw that day of scouting close to 100 cow elk, and we probably saw 20 bulls down on private, but not a single one of them was a 6 point.
Wow.
Which, back to your point, right? These young guys were bugling, and they'd run off all the spikes. So we saw some groups of spikes, you know, 8 or 10 spikes in a group, because they got run off by the raghorns, who a month ago got run off by the 6 points. And so it's like, you know, kind of like when you're riding the school bus when you're, you know, in eighth grade, you know, the 10th grader, he throws you out of his seat. And then, you know, when you become a 10th grader, you throw somebody out of the seat. So,
but what's funny is the eighth graders never learn that you get six or eight of them together ganging up on a 10th grader, and they could do some damage. And those spikes, it's the same. Like, that group of spikes could go in there and probably take over that herd, but they just don't work together.
No, they're not smart enough yet.
No.
So anyhow, in Montana, spikes aren't legal in most units, and it's not in this unit, but not that that really matters. But your observation was identical to ours. Season here opened October 21st, so right in the core of the post rut.
Yep.
And
can I just say, we hunted Montana with you during rifle season 1 year in a unit where you can't shoot spikes. I think it's a phenomenal management idea. Just because we saw so many 2.5 and 3.5 year old bulls, you know, there were 5 points everywhere, which is a lot more exciting to see than a spike. Yeah. And just by not shooting the spikes, it created a, you know, I wouldn't say mature elk pool, but a better elk pool. And I thought it was a great management tool. And I wish we did it here in Idaho, because I mean, I've never shot a spike. I'd do it in a heartbeat in a rifle season, you know, because they're good eating, but I've never shot one, and I think it goes a long ways towards improving the quality of the bulls in an area.
Yeah, and if you think about how much smarter a 2.5 year old bull is compared to a 1.5 year old spike, if you can get them through that year and a half old phase, they now are their chance of escapement and growing into a 6 point or an older bull gets astronomically higher.
Totally.
Yeah. So, and then what you have is you have a lot of hunters who are like, oh, there's a legal bull. Boom. So they shoot these raghorns. So more of the elk get recruited up into the 6 point, you know, 3.5, 4.5, 5.5 year old. So it's the tool Montana uses that allows us to have heavy hunting pressure, long seasons, and still have a decent age class.
Yeah.
So, but anyhow,
sorry, I didn't mean to distract us there, but you mentioned spikes in that season. It reminded me of, you know, we see a lot of spikes here in young bulls, and the only way they get big is if you don't shoot them. And most of us, myself included, we don't get too picky towards the end of season. And if the regulations allow it, then those young bulls don't make it to the next year. So,
yeah. So, on this hunt, we went and did all that scouting in the night before season. Some of those younger bulls were coming, they were on public, and I'm like, all right, Jace. Oh, there, I just ratted him out. Sorry, Jace. We're kind of cooking dinner that night and talking about boy tomorrow morning. Well, we were counting on hunting pressure on the private down below. Because in the past, before the new owner took over, that group allowed some hunting pressure or some hunting. But I had no idea what the situation was with the new owner. So we get up there, and there's not a single hunter out there on the private. And there's just herds of elk. Just like, man, wonder what all that noise is up there on the public. Boy, we hear some loud firecrackers or something up there. So it was mostly an exercise in viewing elk. But about 11 o'clock opening day, it's warm. It's 60 degrees. It's nap time, right? You know, you're kind of facing to the southeast. And so I look over and the Gerber guys, man, they're in nightmare number four or something. I lay down. I kind of put my cap over my eyes to block the sun. And Chase says, I'm going to go for a little walk. I'm like, okay. But, you know, it's noon. What's the harm? Well, I wake up the Gerber guys, and I'm like, hey, you got any things we want to shoot right now? It's kind of the dead period of the day. Let's get it done now. And so, yeah. And Mark, the one camera guy, I tell him, I said, you know how this works. The younger guy, he's got to go run around the hills, and us old guys, we just sit here and the elk just walk by. And I said that at like, I don't know, a little before noon. He's like, is that how it works? I'm like, oh yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've just sat there and someone ran an elk by me. So they're like, okay, here's the shot list. And so they have me doing this and doing that. And they're filming me and taking photographs. And I look up and here's a 5-point bull walking right into our setup. I mean, we are as exposed on this ridgeline as you could possibly be. There's about 5 spruce trees to give us a little bit of shade. And I'm like, guys, here comes a bull. And they're like, what? I'm like, look here, he's coming right now. Get ready. And I'm looking like, where's my camera guy? Where's Jace? And I'm like, well, heck with it. So I grabbed my rifle, and that's when you see the screenshot of me kind of leaned over on my, you know, down on one knee, and the bull walks up to 98 yards and I'm ranging him, and I got him in the crosshairs, and I'm like thinking, boy, this guy, he is dead. But I promised Jace the first shot, and you get this stuff going through your head like, well, he's not a raghorn. He's a 5-point. Oh, Jace, where are you? Finally, I've got him in the crosshairs, and he's just like so dead. He had no idea. Finally, with all the shuffling of all four, me and the 3 Gerber guys up there, he looks up at us, and we're exposed on this ridge, and he's like, oh my gosh, I'm sure that's what just happened. What did I walk into here? And once he sees us, he stands for, you know, 3 or 4 seconds like they do once they see you. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And then he just takes off running down the drainage and pops out down on some private there. And he might still be running for all I know. But about 15 minutes later, I see Jace come walking down the ridgeline. And the 4 of us are just have this smirk on our face. And he's looking around like, what's up?
Yeah.
You should look at Mark's camera there and see what's on the footage or on the screenshots. Jace looks at it. He's like, when did this happen? I'm like, about 20 minutes ago. He's like, what? So he feels terrible. But he says his defense is that if he wouldn't have went on this hike up there, he claims he bumped the bull to us.
Probably.
He might have.
Yeah.
The bull came from the south, came down this drainage on the south side of the ridge. He went around the north side of the ridge, but it maybe could have, but I bet you if he hadn't bumped that bull and we all would have sat there patiently, that bull would have been trying to sneak back to private and he would have walked right past us about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So I'm a man of my word, Corey. If I tell you you get first shot, I'm not shooting.
That's pretty stellar. But if you told me I get first shot and I was off on a stroll and a bull walked right into your setup, mm-hmm. I'm not there for that shot, so I don't get that shot. If you and I are standing side by side and you tell me I get first shot, then I would appreciate if you kept your word. But if I take off and a bull comes into you, I don't get first shot anymore.
I didn't know if he just went to take a dump or what. I didn't know. I thought he might just be, you know, right around the bushes there or something. So, but anyhow, the Gerber guys were kind of disappointed because they'd brought a bunch of prototype knives that they wanted me to work on an elk with. And they looked at each other like, hey, I thought we were here to shoot an elk and get a bunch of pictures and, you know, stuff of carving on an elk with these knives and saws. And it's like, well, sorry, guys, we'll have to shoot one tomorrow. And well, then the next day, this gets to this post-rut mature bull behavior. There's this big timbered ridge that runs out into the private. Again, same replication out in the bottom of the private. There's, you know, 80, 100 cows in different groups and small bulls and spikes. And there's 4 6-point bulls, one of which is probably like a 320-ish bull.
Wow.
And where do you suppose they are? They're on that timbered ridge out there on the private, about 150 yards at most, maybe not even that, into the private. And that's where they spent the day.
Yep.
And then they disappeared somewhere even further into private. So,
and they weren't hanging out with the herds. They were nearby, but they weren't out in the open with the herds. They were,
No, they were a half, three-quarter mile from all the chaos going on with the little guys. So here are 4 6-point bulls, all 4.5 or older, who probably had been fighting and arguing just a month earlier and probably had fought each other a couple times. And they're just like, nah, I think we'll hang out here together. You know, we'll pool our resources. You bed and look that way. You bed and look this way. And we're safe. So we got some footage of them, you know. But so that's just a classic post-rut experience. What you and I both experience is so classic for post-rut.
I like last yours better, October. Though. 60 degrees. Elk. I mean, like a more enjoyable post-rut experience.
Yeah, but I looked at the weather forecast. I climbed up a ridge and got some coverage and got a weather forecast. And it said, oh, an inch of rain starting the next morning, temps drop, snow, converting to snow, heavy winds. And I told the guys, I'm like, look, we're almost 6 miles in here. Do you guys want to get soaking wet and ruin all your camera gear and leave tomorrow? Do you guys want to leave tonight in the dark after we hunt all day? And I had no dissenting votes that we should leave after the hunt on the second day. Well, like all weathermen, it didn't start raining late that night. It started raining at about 3:30 in the afternoon. So we packed up a soak camp, got them on the llamas, hiked out in the dark, and then I got to hang everything in my shop and dry it out. It's like setting up camp again when I got home.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We should get a weather forecaster on this podcast and just find out where do they come up with these forecasts? Like, is it just a flip of a coin or, you know,
you talk about, and I know you said it before, but I can't imagine any other job where your job is to forecast something, but you can be wrong 75% of the time and still have a job and still get pay raises. Like, that's just, and we give weathermen a hard time. I think everybody does, but it's like, why do we even have weather forecasts?
Yeah.
They're very rarely accurate. And with the technology we have today, we should be able to do a better job. And if we can't, then do we really need to be trying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he was right about it turning to snow.
Yeah.
Because the next day, it turned to snow, and it actually got cold. It got down to like 4 degrees or something.
Yeah. See, I think that's right when we started hunting, was right when you packed up and left is when we were going in.
Yeah. And here is how people in Bozeman self-identify that they've only lived here for 6 months. They are the people who, I live 4 miles south of town and the speed limit 60 coming into town. They're the people going 70 on glare packed ice roads, who are down in the rhubarb across the ditch and through the fence. It's like, well, that guy just moved here about 3 or 4 months ago. And that last week of October, if you would have been in the tow truck and body shop business, you probably could have made enough money in a week to retire. welcome to the Rockies, right? Where every little valley town gets all these new arrivals. But the other part, when I came back, I had 6 llamas over in my spare lot. And Marcus called me. He's like, hey, I see it's supposed to stop snowing and get really cold. I want to come and grab those llamas. And me and a buddy and my wife, Kara, we're going to go in for about 4 days of elk hunting. I'm like, cool, come get them. So they did that. And those are wonderful conditions. Once all that weather blows through and you got 10 inches, 12 inches of snow and it gets cold, then those bulls start having to feed a little more also. And needless to say, the llamas got a workout on that trip. That's just kind of the post-rut period. Now we're into this, you know, what I call late season period of November. And I know people are saying, well, it's warm in Montana, or it was warm in Wyoming or whatever. The hunting, if you have a season that's open right now, it just gets better and better every day. And for bull elk, anyhow. Yeah.
So you're going to Arizona, right? Rifle in Arizona this year. You still have a tag there. Still going down.
Yeah, me and my son have tags down there.
How does it change there? Because I mean, they don't get the bitter cold. They don't get the, you know, I have to go out and feed. So how does post rut and late season? What's the status of the elk down there during that time?
Arizona and New Mexico, it's, you know, that's more horizontal territory than it is vertical, like where we live. So they disperse horizontally rather than vertically, but they still disperse. The bulls break off into their bachelor groups, and they just know that when the days start getting shorter, somewhere along the way, an awful lot of vehicles start driving around and camps are getting set up. And you know, about that time, old Pete, he stood around by the road last year and he got a victory lap in somebody's Silverado or something. they just figure it out. They know, at least the mature bulls. Yeah. And so they are in sanctuary areas. And what are sanctuary areas in these flatter environments? Well, if you do find a canyon, that's a sanctuary area. If you find a place that's roaded or gated where the rest of the stuff is roaded, those are sanctuary areas. Sometimes these big, vast carpets of pinyon juniper are a sanctuary because once you dive in there, you can't see anything.
Yeah.
And they're not calling. They're not bugling.
So do they come? So, I mean, like we would rely, you know, obviously on elk needing to feed because it's cold, they've got to replenish body fat, all of that, and we would hope that we would be able to catch them out on an open hillside. Any of that, like in those landscapes, are they out feeding? Are they still glassing in a canyon on an open hillside?
Yep. If you look at my e-scouting, I have every water source marked, and anything that's a canyon or a gated off area within 2 miles of that water source, those are my e-scouting places.
And are the elk still hitting water sources consistently during that time?
Yeah. I mean, the smart ones, they know it's a nighttime affair.
Yeah.
The younger, you know, the cows, they'll come in 4 in the afternoon, and some of the younger bulls will. The older boys, they just know the drill. They got to be 6 years old for a reason, but the places to consistently find them are those canyon areas where most people don't want to go. And then there are some places in Arizona and New Mexico that do have some elevation and terrain. And that's the other place where a lot of guys just don't want to go. And, you know, we'll set up when we hunt those states, we'll set up on a little point overlooking a canyon, or we'll set up on a little knoll that overlooks a big carpet of pinyon juniper, or we'll get on an opposing face where it's a mountain or a hillside, and we'll get on the opposing face. And if you see them feeding, you may not get to them that day because they're, you know, a mile and a half away, but they're not going to be far away in the morning. And so you make sure you're there right at daylight, and usually they are. And
I mean, we were sitting there, it was, you know, about 10 degrees in the morning. We're trying to glass and my hands are going numb because it's so cold out. I can only hold them up on the binoculars for about a minute and a half, and I have to put them back in my pocket. And I thought, I wonder what the late rifle hunts in Arizona are like compared to this. I bet it's warmer. Bet you don't have to backpack in with a bunch of blowdown. And it definitely got me thinking that if I'm going to do a late season rifle hunt, I should probably be looking at a place that's more of a vacation climate than a survival climate.
I mean, you get in some spots in Arizona up on what they call the rim, the Mogollon Rim, or even in western New Mexico or northern New Mexico, you know, your elevations are 8,000 feet. So I've had some hunts, the late season hunts in Arizona, where it was below zero. And, you know, that kind of shocks you a little bit. The flip side of it is, though, most days it gets up in the 30s or 40s. And, but the bulls, they it's just like everywhere else. The older bulls respond to hunting pressure, and even though these aren't states with general seasons, they still find these sanctuary areas that just nobody wants to mess with. And, you know, in New Mexico, there's a lot more private land than there is in Arizona. And so they know where those boundaries are. They don't have, you know, go hunt maps on a phone or anything, but they somehow know it.
They know right where that line of pressure always just mysteriously stops.
Yeah. And for me, I have, when, you know, these are always short seasons in those states. I try to get, if there's ever a place where the 2 days of scouting pays dividends, it's a hunt like that. So I'm getting down there 2 days early, and I'm going to go check every one of my, or as many as I can, of my top e-scouted locations and see what I find. And opening morning, I'm going to have a place where I want to be based on what I find. But then once the shooting starts, it's like, okay, where are the elk going to go in response to this? And I have a whole nother series of places I'm going to look at once the hunting pressure gets pretty intense. So I'll abandon what might be my best spot for opening day, and I might never go back there once the shooting starts, because it's like, you know what, they're going to bail out of here. So we'll see. I might come home and tell you, Corey, we didn't see an elk. Don't listen to anything I said.
I'm just looking in my Go Hunt point tracker here. I jumped in to see you. I've got too many points in Arizona to burn them on a late hunt right now. I think I'm up to 17 points there. So I'm going to get another good archery rut hunt in there. But after that, I might maybe start looking at doing something later in the season. Colorado, I burned my elk points last year, and so I'm slowly starting to build that. And I'll probably do the same thing there, just something that's a lot easier to draw a deer in Colorado. I'm sitting on back up to 17 or 18 points.
Whew.
But you and I were talking about Montana, and I've got I'll have nine bonus points in Montana. Of course, they wiped out all my preference points, because if you have more than two, they kick you back down to zero. So
the good news is you got better chance of drawing Montana with 0 points than you do with one.
That's so crazy.
That's
when you were doing telling me about the math on that, I just thought, that's so messed up. That's
like Russian math or something there, and that doesn't make any sense. But I'm gonna be in Arizona on December 1st, so I'm gonna be far away from service, so I'm not gonna get the chance to involve myself in your Idaho chaos that you guys cooked up. That anyone who wants to frustrate themselves, I'm gonna give you a chance to do this on December 1st, folks. Sign into your account, I don't know, like a half hour before the posted time or an hour before the posted time. And the general deer and elk tags are going to go on sale at, I can't remember, is 9 a.m. 10 a.m.? Okay. And all of us non-residents get thrown in a, they call it a green room, I guess.
Waiting room. Yeah.
And then they randomize us and put us in a line. And then the first maybe 100 people are going to be there. And then the site's going to crash. And you're going to lose your place in line if you bail. So, I mean, I understand that Idaho residents couldn't give two poops about how bad this system is. But it is the most messed up, screwed up system for allocating tags of any system I have ever seen. It's like, you guys must have hired some engineers to say, let's see just how frustrating we can make this process. So
it boggles my mind to think that we're in 2023. Mm-hmm. And there's been online applications for a long time.
Yeah.
And this is the system they came up with as the best system for non-residents obtaining a tag.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, so we've made some changes. Idaho's cut back on the amount of tags that are issued to non-residents for deer and elk here in the last few years. They used to be, if there were non-resident tags available, and they would never sell out. Residents could buy them as an extra tag starting on August 1st. There were times I would buy a leftover non-resident elk tag at the end of September, and there were still tags available. Yeah, they just didn't. But obviously things have changed on the landscape, and a few years ago they started selling out. So now December 1st is the date when those tags become available, and they sell out within a couple hours. If they can keep the system up long enough to sell them out. If not, sometimes it's 8 hours or 10 hours by the time they get the system back up and people buy those tags. Mm-hmm. But it is, they still say it's an over-the-counter opportunity to buy a tag in Idaho. However, like you said, you go into your account, you have to buy a license in order to buy a tag. So you buy your license ahead of time for $170 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then they stick you in this waiting room. Mm-hmm. And then at 10 o'clock, they all of a sudden dish out these random numbers that say, you might have been the first one to log in here this morning and get ready to buy your tag, but you are number 10,451 in line to buy your tag. And you get to watch the little status bar. There are 10,450 people in front of you. And then an hour later, there are 9,964 people in front of you. And you realize all the tags are gone at this point, so you aren't going to get one. So I don't know how it's nothing but a lottery. I mean, it really at this point is a lottery. Right. You are given a random number that determines your place in line. So the online portion of it is a lottery. However, if you live somewhere close to Idaho, you can drive across the border to a Fish and Game Regional.
Quiet.
No, it's
quiet.
It has to happen so they can make a change to the system. Okay. Otherwise, everybody who's driving and buying these tags, but that again, you're taking a gamble. Because if you're going to drive 6 hours or 8 hours to Idaho and stand in line at a place, you may or may not get the license or the tag you want. But then when the system goes down, you may be standing there for 8 or 10 hours without an option to do it. And then it comes back up online, and all these people online get the tag. So, I mean, it's never a guarantee. Yeah. People have learned that I have a chance if I drive there, but it's a bigger risk. They've just got to change the system.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's interesting to see what has happened in Idaho, what's happened in other states. There's this thing called the artificial scarcity theory. And we saw it in Montana. There's a unit in Montana that the elk hunting got so bad, they put it on a limited entry unit to protect the few remaining bulls. And when they put it on a limited entry unit, demand went through the roof. Because everyone's like, oh, look, this is hard to draw.
Must be good.
This is a limited entry tag. It must be good. And the Region 3 big game manager called me and she's like, Randy, what's the deal here? I'm like, well, anytime you make something scarce and limited, it's going to create more demand because people are like, well, I want to have it in my back pocket as sort of a, you know, if I got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now she says, I tell these people, this is a terrible unit to hunt. The bull to cow ratios are in the crapper. The total elk herd numbers are in the crapper. Don't waste your points here. But people are like, oh boy, it's a limited entry. There's a limited quantity. So
that biologist just wants to hunt there herself. So that's why she's telling everybody it's bad. That's
yeah. No,
conspiracy theorist.
No, I'm here to vouch for you. It sucks. I don't hunt there. But you know, if you look at Idaho, what was it 5 years ago when you guys cinched down the non-resident tags for deer and elk by a unit or core region or whatever? The total number of tags that you guys gave prior to that was way, way less than how many people get in line now to buy an Idaho tag.
Oh, yeah.
So back in the, if you look at how much interest there was in Idaho back in the day, if there would have been this many people interested, they would have sold out 5 years ago so fast. But you guys didn't put a cap on it back then, really. There was not a danger of running out of tags.
Exactly. Yeah, we've had the same cap forever. And so, you know, that argument of, oh, there's so many non-resident hunters. Well, there's no more non-resident tags then. You know, it's been capped. So that's not an excuse. I think the problem is people get concentrated. So that's why the Fish and Game said, okay, we're only going to allow a certain amount of people in each unit to help spread everything out. So same number of tags. They did reduce the tags there a little bit. But the idea was, will force them into certain areas so that it can't all, because before, literally, you know, the non-resident tags could all go to one zone, one area.
Right.
They all 17,000 or however many of them there were could end up in the same place. So now they're spread out. Hunting success rate here, because you brought up a point that I've been wanting to make for quite a while. The argument against, you know, technology and everything. But I have all the statistics from going back to 1995.
Corey's looking at spreadsheets right now. I can tell because his brow is all furled up.
I've got it pulled up here. So going back to 1995. So in 2001, we've got every single unit in Idaho, every single season, and these are over-the-counter, so not taking into account anything controlled. Success rates, percentage of 6 points. Idaho's been tracking all of that since the late 90s.
Yeah.
And the overall success rate in, well, let me just do this. I'm going to freeze this row because it'll help me be able to see it here a little better. So we've got success rate and then total number of hunters. In, let's go, 2001, so 22 years ago, success rate overall, this is antlerless, antlered, rifle, muzzleloader, archery, anything that you could buy over the counter in 2001, success rate was 18.14%.
Okay.
And total number of hunters was
150,000.
108,000. 109,000 if you round up. 109,000. And they killed almost 20,000 elk in 2001.
Yep. Okay.
Now, I'm not going to go through every year, but I'll just jump ahead to 2022.
Okay. Are we over or above the 18.14% success rate?
17.1.
Okay.
And so, as you look through, and that's the thing that I want to do a graph on, but it hasn't varied by more than 2% since 2001 to 2022. It's been 16.5% to 20% success rate. It hasn't changed. If anything, it's gone down. There's a slight trend of success rates going down.
Okay.
So you could make the argument of, well, yeah, success rates have gone down because there's so many more people that the elk are smarter and they're getting harder to hunt. You know, the technology advancements make it easier to kill them when you can find them, but now they're harder to find. You know, whatever it is, the success rates, which are what the game agencies really manage for, are staying the same. You know, they aren't changing much at all. The number of hunters on the landscape, you know, you hear all of our resident hunters in every state say non-residents are the devil. They, you know, there's way too many of them. There's way more people out in the field. Randy and Corey have ruined elk hunting by generating all of these new elk hunters. Everywhere you go now, there's just all these new elk hunters.
Okay.
2001.
Right. 109,000.
109,000. You know how many elk hunters were in Idaho in 2022?
Yeah, I want to know.
76,000.
What? Hold on. So a drop of 30,000?
30,000 fewer elk hunters in Idaho than there was 20 years ago.
Wait, now that everybody says, no, there's triple the number of elk hunters.
And they also say there's way too many non-residents, even though it's been capped for 20 some years in Idaho. Yeah, and five years ago, it got reduced and capped by unit.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there's been, so just looking at, I just want to go like 2017. So if we go back 6 years, 78,000 elk hunters, 17% success. 2018, 17% success, 81,000 elk hunters. 2019, 16.5% success, 85,000 elk hunters. 2020, 17.5% success, 86,000 elk hunters. 2021, 16.5% success, 77,000 elk hunters. I mean, it is so, nothing has changed. Like it's keeping pretty straight lines. So what's the issue? I want people to comment, you know, send us an email and tell us what's really the issue here. Randy and I have not ruined hunting. We have not generated all these elk hunters coming in. Yes, there are changes to processes and how you can get elk tags. Yes, there are advancements in technologies that allow you to scout differently and everything. But there are 30,000 fewer elk hunters in Idaho each year than there were 20 years ago. Advancements in technology have not changed success rates at all. They've not, if anything, they've gone down by 1 or 2%. So what's the excuse? Is it wolves? Is it, you know, I mean, let's put the blame where it really is, but those are statistics. This is not being made up. I went through and there are 1600 caller Excel cells in each of these years spreadsheets that have been compiled, and this is what it is.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Now we have some fodder to at least defend ourselves when people say that we've ruined it and we've brought all these elk hunters in and all of these extra elk hunters are just ruining it. There's no elk left. And
We get those comments. I just like, no, I don't know what to tell you. Someone taught me how to do this stuff and someone was nice enough to work their butt off to put more elk on the landscape. I'm going to do the same thing that someone did for me. And I get people are going to, it's cool to have something to blame, you know, whether it's wolves or, you know, Corey and Randy or, but whatever, you know, technology, you know, they should have never come up with digital maps because I do feel that digital maps have, if there's ever been something that revealed where my quote unquote honey holes were.
Yeah.
When digital maps became available on phones, I don't have any quote unquote honey holes anymore. Yeah. The whole world knows.
There's no secret elk spots.
Yeah, but no, we get that stuff. And I get that people are frustrated, you know, because something didn't work out the way they wanted that year. But you've heard me say it a million times, if you want to improve your odds, and I don't care what species it's for, put more critters on the mountain. You've heard me go into my scarcity versus abundance thinking. That's research is real. It's out there if you look into it. You know, are we going to be scarcity thinkers and say, well, let's just fight over something and not do anything to improve what we're the amount of, you know, the size of the pie, as we've always called it. Or are we going to try put more on the landscape? And that's just the way I look at it. And
we've limited the number of people. The number of people, you know, there's a quota on the non-resident tags in Idaho. Most states mm-hmm. have that. So we've done that. We've limited it. We've made it scarce.
Yeah.
Now we're looking for somebody to blame because our success rates are not good. But technology has made success rates so high now there's no elk. I mean, it's just we're talking in circles. When we really stop and look at it, what you just said is the best solution. Get more access. Get more animals on the landscape. Quit worrying about if there's two extra non-resident hunters or if somebody's sharing information. It's happening. That stuff's going on. Let's do something about it. Let's not just complain on the internet about it. Let's get involved. Let's make more opportunity.
Yeah.
That's what's going to change it.
Yep. Well, you know, as you're saying that, I can hear all the Colorado guys saying, wait a second, Corey, that might be the case in Idaho, but let me tell you what's happened in Colorado with all of our over-the-counter units. And in response to that pressure, Colorado has had, it's kind of like you have in Idaho, a huge growth in resident population. Yep. And so the residents, as it should be, residents should get priority in every state. And that's why we have a state-based model. And we can go into why that is, going back to 1842, when the U.S. Supreme Court said wildlife was one of the assets retained by the states, never granted to the federal government when we formed this country. Therefore, the fishings, hawkings, and fowlings, I think is what they called it back in that decision. What they meant is wildlife.
Yeah.
Is a right retained by the state and held in trust for the citizens of that state. Not for the citizens of other states, but for the citizens of that state, and their support for it was this thing called the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution. So anyone who tells me we need a federal-based system of wildlife, mm-hmm. I'm like, well, first of all, I think you've lost your mind. Second of all, we have this thing called the U.S. Constitution. That is a pretty important document. You know, it's kind of what we live by around it. At least I thought it had some relevance. And it says, any rights not granted to the federal government are retained by the state kind of by default. So it's got to be a right explicitly granted to the federal government before it's a federal system. And so that's why we have a state-based model. People may not like it. If you don't live in an elk state, you might say, I hate this system. Well, I don't know what to tell you, but, you know, it's been around for 181 years now.
I pay taxes on federal land. I should be able to go and hunt animals on federal land anyway. You know, you hear that argument
all the time.
And you are more than welcome to go and hike, backpack, camp, all that. But those animals are a possession and a
trust asset
of the residents of that state.
Right. And so that court case addressed this very issue that you brought up. It's called Martin versus Waddell. And it said, regardless of where this wildlife lives, it does not matter who owns the deeded property. It doesn't matter that it's on federal land or state land or private land. That has no bearing to who has say and control over the trusteeship of the wildlife that moves back and forth across this land. So I ask people, if you want to make the case that, hey, I am a U.S. citizen, and therefore I shouldn't have any restrictions against my ability to hunt federal land, well, you're then saying that land ownership should be what drives hunting allocation. Okay, let's take that to its next step that is a parallel. Yeah, do you want the private landowners to have all the tags? In Montana, we're 2/3 private land. You're saying you want the landowners of Montana then to have control.
Access to those wildlife.
To 2/3 of the wildlife in Montana. That's what you're really saying when you're making that case. And I get the frustration. I understand it. I wish I could be on the same footing as New Mexico residents for drawing elk tags, but I'm not, and I shouldn't be, as much as my personal desires are.
You want to be. Yeah.
Yeah. I shouldn't be. And that is the model that this country has used for wildlife since 1842.
And has to. I mean, that's the model that's going to work. Like you said, if we go to land-based wildlife management, land ownership-based wildlife management, that's a lot of wildlife lives on private land. And now it becomes even a bigger scheme of who's got the deepest pockets to be able to hunt the king's wildlife.
Right. And so if you think about the history of the people who came here from Europe, they got arms chopped off. They got put into, you know, indentured servancy for shooting the king's hog or deer or whatever it may be. So when this was something that was prevalent and a big issue when a lot of those folks came to the new land called America. And they made a conscious decision. This wasn't by some random circumstance. They made the conscious decision that in this country, it will not be the king's deer.
Yep. Well, that was a long time ago. Things have changed, so we probably need to relook at that, right?
Yeah. So if we're going to look at that, do we no longer hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator, with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Are we going to say that doesn't matter either?
Man, well, there's some people saying that, yeah.
Yeah. Anyhow, this argument gets made all the time. And I get it's an expression of frustration. For people who, you know, I can't hunt elk in South Dakota because they don't give any to non-residents. No. I can't hunt moose in North Dakota. North Dakota gives away more moose tags than my state of Montana. And in Montana, we give away 10% of our moose tags to non-residents. North Dakota gives away 0 moose tags to non-residents. And that's their right to do that. Because this is a state-based asset. And a lot of people want to try and say, well, we should all be beneficiaries of the public trust. You are a beneficiary of a public trust, but it's the public trust of wildlife in the state of which you are a citizen.
Yep.
So I can really wish, boy, I'd love to go to North Dakota and shoot one of those big moose they're shooting there. But guess what? I'm not one of the beneficiaries of their public trust arrangement that holds the wildlife in trust for their citizens of North Dakota. So I have no standing.
Well, and there's been lawsuits, you know, the New Mexico was sued. Yep. The state of New Mexico was sued because they were discriminating against where people lived and how they were delivering their wildlife tags.
Arizona was sued also.
Yep. And both of those, you know, there was a short term little victory for the people who brought the case, but those were overturned. Yeah. And ultimately, and now, it comes down to the state can discriminate based on where you live on how they allocate wildlife opportunities.
Right. You know, and if you think about it from the terms of a trust has trustees, a trust has a corpus, in other words, the asset, and in this case, wildlife and wildlife opportunity, and it has beneficiaries. So the trustees are responsible for managing the trust corpus, the wildlife, on behalf of the beneficiaries.
Are they responsible for it, they're mandated.
Mandated. Under most, yes, but can't say they always do that. But so the point is, though, how do you become a beneficiary? You are a beneficiary because of where you are a citizen. I have no rights to claim Arkansas should manage ducks for me, or that Texas should manage white-tailed deer for me, or that Alaska should manage doll sheep for me, because I'm not a resident in any of those states. Any opportunity I get from those states is merely because the trustees have said there's enough here that we will share some of this with people who are not a beneficiary.
In a lot of times, the name of revenue.
Yeah.
Because there is an opportunity there that, you know, residents would be up in arms if we tried to generate enough revenue from our,
right,
our portion of our state-owned wildlife just from the residents. So they say, you know what, if you're willing to give up, say, 10% of your pool of this wildlife, we can generate a whole bunch of revenue because of the scarcity here and people's willingness to the demand to come and hunt our animals. And yep, we'll make up a majority of our revenue in doing that. The other option is we could shut off. I mean, any state could say, nah, no non-residents are going to come and hunt or fish in our state because we own them. And we're not going to let anybody in here. There's nothing anybody can do about that. And we feel that our residents will make up the revenue. You know, I think there's I don't know. I see states that are starting to go that way. Maybe not completely, but, you know, once they realize, hey, residents are willing to pay an extra 20%, mm-hmm, we can just get rid of the whole debacle of December 1st in Idaho and not give out any non-resident tags.
That's what a trustee is charged with balancing.
Yep.
Okay. We have these beneficiaries that are state citizens. We want them to enjoy this wildlife asset, this corpus of the trust. But we don't want them to have to pay a lot. So we're going to sell X percentage or X number of tags to non-residents, and we're going to rake them over the coals. We're going to follow the Montana model where you non-residents are going to pay 40X or maybe even more what our residents pay.
For but the you know exact what? Same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know some people don't like it, and I know people say, well, it's becoming a rich man's game, or, you know, you hear that all the time.
Yeah.
As long as I've been alive, non-resident hunting has been expensive. My dad and his hunting buddies, they thought it was a big deal if they went to the next county to hunt something. So if we put it in the bigger perspective, I never dreamed I would be blessed with the opportunity to travel to as many states as I do to hunt. That just was a foreign concept when I was growing up. My parents and grandparents are like, I'm not, that's expensive. I'm not going to do that. As a percentage of what my dad made as a Gippo logger who, you know, couldn't even afford his fuel bill down at the jobber station, for him to have went to Colorado elk hunting, he'd have been like, no way, that is insane. That's like 10% of my annual
income. That's frivolous spending. There's no way I can put a priority on being able to do that.
So my dad's generation thought non-resident hunting was so ridiculously expensive that they didn't do it. So this statement that it's a rich man's game or a woman's game.
It's always been.
It has always been that way.
Probably more so then than it is now, because we are able, you know, I think without very many exceptions, most people who want to hunt elk in another state are able to make that happen. I mean, it might take some sacrifice. You might have to give up some things financially. You may have to work an extra job or do some overtime, but there are opportunities with very few limitations. That if you want to go and do something like that, whether it's duck hunting in Arkansas, whether it's elk hunting in Colorado, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, you can make it happen. Now, there are opportunities from a financial standpoint to make that happen. Now, when tags become private, you know, when the privatization of opportunity, such as landowner permits and things like that get involved, then that access can become a rich man's state or a rich man's sport.
Yep.
But the actual ability to go and hunt an animal is no more out of reach and maybe less so today financially than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah. I always hesitate to get into these discussions, Corey, because I can just see people driving down the road, banging their fist on the dashboard. You SOBs, you don't understand. I do understand. In fact, we have a video that we have put the final bow on, and we're going to publish it. I don't know when. And I'm waiting for a huge amount of blowback from this video. And it's a video of how I was able to fulfill my hunting dreams financially. Because I grew up in a very poor logging town. My parents divorced when I was 10. I'm the oldest of three. My mom was a waitress in a diner. No one had money to... And I know this sounds...
In the 70s.
Yeah. So I know people are thinking I'm trying to paint this as a woe is me. That's not why I'm painting this story. I'm painting this story that people think that if you have some successes in life, you work hard, you take some risks, and maybe they pay off because you got a little lucky to go with your hard work, that somehow that was the path that you were born into. In this little town of Big Falls, Minnesota, we were all so poor, we didn't know we were. The whole town was on the wrong side of the tracks. We didn't know. We all had to figure it out. We, you know, I've been self-employed since I was about 8. I started a lawn mowing service. I started a bait shop. I picked night crawlers. I trapped minnows. I had a trap line for weasels and muskrats and mink. And then on the weekends, once you got big enough that you weren't going to cut your leg off, you got to go work out in the woods. And so that's all I knew. So I pay for my own college. I do everything and da-da-da. But I want people to have the ability to satisfy their hunting dreams. And that gets back to what you just said, Corey, of how if somebody makes it a priority, the odds are they can go do this. But it's got to be a priority.
And there are a lot of places in the world that still enjoy that opportunity and those right. freedoms to be able to say, you know what? I want to be able to go and hunt animals in another state. That's my desire. There are people yep. in other country like, I want to be able to have warm bread for dinner, you know, and that's their focus and their priority. And we lose touch of that. And I mean, it's a resource. It's a business model, but we live in a pretty special place that allows us those opportunities where we are arguing about, well, it's not fair because they get to do this and they get to do that. Well, right. nobody's entitled to anything. But if you work hard, there's an opportunity to earn just about anything you want to be able to do. The sky's the limit.
Yeah. And so in this video, I talk about when I turned 30, I remember sitting down and feeling this, you know, I'm never going to get to do this. I can't afford that. I'm never going to get, you know, and I've had myself in that, if I don't know if you want to call it the must be nice theory, you know, I would look at guys who went on hunts and I'd be like, oh, must be nice. Well, I sat down on my 30th birthday and I told my wife, I'm like, look, Kim, I want to go do these things someday before I die. There are 4 or 5 places I really want to go and they're expensive. But it's a priority for me, and I'm willing to make a lot of sacrifices. So for 25 years, I, in the household funds, I carved away $200 a month. And $200 a month for me and my family in 1994, when I just paid off student loans, I think we're still paying off doctor bills from having a baby. I wanted to start my own CPA firm. And then when I did that, I wanted to have my own office building. $200 a month for me was like a sacrifice to the nth degree. But it was my priority. And I asked my wife, what is your priority? Let's get disciplined. Let's quit doing some of the things that pollute or make it foggy about what our priorities are. Because I realized that every time I spend money, it's a statement of what my priorities are, at least totally. With any discretionary money. Anytime I decide I'm going to go and borrow money for something, that's a statement of what my priority is, both short-term and long-term. And I said, my priority is this. I want to go hunt sheep in Alaska. I want to hunt the Cassiars. I want to hunt the Yukon, and I want to hunt the Mackenzie Mountains before I die. So I've done three of those four now, and I'm very thankful that most people say, man, that's so cool that you saved and you made, this was a goal you set when you were 30. And I want people to understand that whatever that goal is, you got to make it a priority if that is your dream, if that's what you want to do. And maybe you say, look, I want to hunt elk in the West every year for the rest of my life. And that's what you're going to set some money aside for. And your spouse is going to do the same for whatever his or her priorities are. It's kind of a little bit of a, I don't know who this Dave Ramsey guy is, but everyone tells me he's like some like financial expert or whatever. And the crew is like, man, you're sounding like Dave Ramsey. I'm like, I don't know who the hell he is. There used to be a Dave Ramsey hockey player. I knew it, but so point is, in all of this stuff, to say this is a rich man's game, it always has been. And the people who have went and done it are the people who made it a priority. My dad didn't make it a priority because he liked really cheap beer and lots of it. And he liked cigarettes and smokes. And, something like that was never a priority on my dad's list. So he was never going to go do it. But it's a priority for me.
Yep.
And so through making these monthly sacrifices, if you want to call it that, driving an older car, I mean, we could have moved into a bigger house earlier if we would have wanted to, but it just is like, well, that means I'm not going to get to go do these things that I want to do. And I'm really struggling with how do you tell people that when you're on the back end of that tube, yeah. Right? You're coming out the other end. And I'm trying to explain to them, when I started entering this journey, it seemed really difficult. But once I got in the mode of doing it, it was not, I no longer had this, oh, must be nice when I saw someone talk about they went grizzly hunting in the Yukon, or they went wherever it might have been. You know, they went to Arizona on an elk hunt. I was like, holy cow, man. Now, yeah, once I decided this was going to be my priority, it became like this positive thing. It was no longer this, oh, the other guy, must be nice. And I really felt it last month when I was in the Yukon, the satisfaction of having a great hunt and being with great people was like it always is. But I was sitting there on this mountain overlooking this unbelievable landscape that I've dreamed of, and it exceeded my expectation. And the satisfaction of thinking back 30 some years ago when I decided this was, or 20 some years ago, that this was going to be my priority, and to have worked and worked and saved and checked every box, and being able to say, I did it. The accomplishment of a plan, the carrying out of a plan that got me to a dream, whether I would have shot the smallest caribou or the smallest moose in the Yukon wouldn't have really mattered. The real satisfaction internally came from setting a goal and accomplishing it. And I'm trying to put that into words in a way where people don't just roll their eyes and say, oh, well, you're an accountant. You're, da, da, da.
Accountants really have to save money? I mean, really, Randy, yeah, that.
I know. And so when we get these emails about, Western hunting has become a rich man's game, we get a bunch of emails also from people who say, you know what? I've figured out how I can go and hunt elk in the West every year. And yeah, I got to make a few sacrifices, but I do it, yep. And so.
Well, there's such a deeper discussion there too on, are you a doctor? Are you an engineer? Are you an accountant? Are you a, a factory worker? All these different things. It really doesn't matter. And, I see the younger generation. Basketball season starts tonight. I spent this week at Open Gym. So I'm hanging out with 15, 16 year old boys again and seeing that mentality. Uh-huh. And, you know, they have to learn hard work. And when you learn the principle of hard work, it doesn't matter what your job, but when you learn discipline, it doesn't matter. I mean, you're going to be able to live comfortably, whatever that means. You're going to make decisions that allow you to live within your means and live comfortably. And within that landscape, there's going to be an opportunity to make sacrifices and save. And whether you want to buy a lift kit for your truck and that's your dream, whether you want to go hunt elk in Arizona, whether you want to do a family vacation to Disneyland, whatever it is, you have opportunity to save and to build. And that's more a matter of discipline and decision and priority than it is of what you were born with, what you have to work with, where you are in life. You know, I think that's a more important thing to learn at a younger age than, you know, so many people see, they have their dreams and they just say, I want to be rich. And they sit there and they flip through YouTube for 6 hours straight and they go to bed upset and jealous because somebody else has more money than them. It's like, well, what could have you done with that 6 hours that you just wasted? You work an 8 hour day and you come home to a young family. You know, all these things, there might not be a time right there, an opportunity to build what you want to build. But when you have that vision, when you have the priority, and then you have the discipline to make it happen, anything's possible.
Yeah. And that kind of is what I'm trying to express. And I don't know how you do it well. I'm just trying to state it from my standpoint of how my life was. And when I got to a certain age, I realized that 99% of my happiness and I was in control of 99% of my happiness and 99% of my future based on my attitude and my perspectives. All of a sudden, life just got so much easier, so much more fulfilling that I don't know how you convey that. I don't know how you say it. I don't know. I think people almost got to live through it. But I'm 100% convinced that my happiness is driven by me. Absent some crazy health event, we are pretty much in charge of our own futures. Yep. And whether that's you got a future where you want to hunt a lot, like you and I are blessed to do, or your future is, hey, I want to go and play a golf course in every state, or I want to go and travel Europe, or I want to go, whatever it is, you are the one who's in charge of that. And for the person who has done that and set those goals and made it work, I don't know how to answer the question when it's posed of, oh, must be nice. All I can say is, yeah, it's really nice to have had a dream, had a plan, and seen it come together. What's really nice about it is my health held up long enough for me to do it.
Yeah.
And I know this is really getting out from maybe what people listen to this podcast for about elk hunting or my terrible marriage advice. but I want people to feel empowered. I want them to understand that when I started applying across multiple states every year in 1995, it was a huge financial accommodation to my household. And I didn't apply at every state. I started in Colorado. And then I tried to build enough pot of money that I could add another state every year. It wasn't like I got out of college and someone handed me $100,000 and say, here you go, Randy, just hunt your life away.
Really? That's not how it works?
No. I mean, I could get into the stories of how much risk I took, you know, along the way. And this is where I feel that people hear me say, I'm the luckiest guy on the planet. Because when I did take a lot of risks and really got myself out there a little further, some people get a streak of bad luck and it all collapses.
Yeah.
I lucked out. I did not have that streak of bad luck or bad health or whatever at my most exposed time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't care what people say, oh, Randy, you worked your butt off, blah, blah, blah. You don't attribute that to luck.
There's no. Always some luck. It's like elk hunting.
Yeah. I mean, life isn't fair. And some people might have taken the same exact risks, put themselves in the same exact situation I did, and they would have had some bad luck, and the outcome would have been different.
Yep.
So I'm here to say I am the luckiest guy on the planet. And my job is to get up every day and show appreciation for that. And I want everybody who's listening, who has a dream of hunting elk every year or some special trip or whatever it might be, you and your spouse, it's a decision. It's a daily decision of, okay, I'm going to go buy some more schnooze, or I'm going to buy a 12 pack of beer, or I'm going to, you know, my truck only has 45,000 miles on it, but I'd like a newer one. And it, every time you do that, that's a statement of what your priority is for your financial future.
Absolutely.
And, so anyhow,
no. I think this is I think that's a great place to start to land the plane here, because it's Veterans Day, and there's been a lot of sacrifices made by a lot of people that enable us to have the freedoms that we do, to be able to have those dreams and pursue happiness and all of that. And so on Veterans Day, we say thank you. And like you said, thank you is not enough, but hopefully today is a day to remind us that every day we need to be grateful for the sacrifices that have been made and that continue to be made. And if you're listening, you're not going to hear this on Veterans Day, but take an opportunity to thank a veteran. And I just, you know, I've got a quick story I want to share. On 4th of July, I was cleaning out my garage, and there's two bows hanging there that just haven't been shot. You know, I retired them a couple years ago or whatever, and I thought, how can I do with these? And I thought, it's 4th of July. I'm going to give them away to a veteran. So on Instagram, I just jumped out and said, hey, if you know a veteran, I've got a couple bows. Here are the specs on them. If you know somebody that could use them, send me an email. Well, that's always, or not an email, but a message on Instagram. And that's always a gamble and a roll of the dice, asking people to contact you on Instagram. But it was so inspiring to read. And I didn't want people, you know, recommending themselves. I wanted somebody to recommend, hey, if you know somebody that's a veteran or that's served or is serving, let me know. And hundreds of messages. And so to be able to read all of them, some of them were short. I've got a buddy that lives down the road. He's in the Army or whatever. But so many of them took time to detail the sacrifices that these individuals make and why they would be deserving of receiving a bow. And so I picked one. His name was Colin. And I sent him a bow, and he was more than grateful. Like, just it was a huge highlight. And it's something that's sitting in my garage not being used. But he sent me a message on September 24th. It all came together this year. I finally filled a tag, hit him at 20 yards on a solo hunt September 19th. So happy that I could give you the thanks you asked for. I know it's been a minute, but I should have a thank you gift in the mail this week. Thank you for the bow. It's an honor to be hunting with it and to continue to carry it for many more, with a picture of him and an elk. So cool. Something is, so like you said, thank you isn't enough.
Right.
Sending a bow to one person isn't enough, but it's a thank you to one person. And if we all take the time to do something, just to say thank you to them, it's going to mean a lot to them. And it'll help us appreciate maybe a little more of the freedoms that we do have, and maybe quit squabbling about the few things that we don't have, and making excuses and using jealousy to justify those feelings. And so on Veterans Day, thank you to all who have served. Thank you to all who continue to serve. And we live in the greatest nation in the world, although it's got some issues and some problems, some weaknesses. It's still the best place to live, and we still enjoy the greatest opportunities of any nation in the world.
Oh, man, Corey, I don't know. You winged that, and you didn't read it from a script. And I couldn't say it any better. And all the things we've talked about, you know, the blessings I've had, none of those happen without those people who put their lives out there every day, and their families who are back here while they're serving.
Yeah.
Those families make huge sacrifices. I wish I had a better word than thank you, but that's the only word I know of. And, you know, the things that, we can do to help people is also a wonderful thing.
You know,
where you and I are blessed that we get to touch a lot of people, and if we can do that, it makes the world a better place. So your story there, that given that bow, is, you know, that's cool, and just speaks to you. And
I don't share that to pat myself on the back for giving a bow away. I share it because we take for granted sometimes that, you know, I have a new bow. And maybe somebody who has given so much so that I have the freedoms, maybe they don't have a bow or a free, you know, a nice bow. And so to be able to do something there to honor what he's done and to give back just in a small way makes a big difference to them. So,
yeah. And for those of us who can, let's do it.
Yep. And if you can't, find somebody and say thank you at the very least. Yeah. Just be mindful that others are sacrificing so that we can live comfortable.
Yeah. Well, that is a good place to wrap it up.
Excellent. Well,
you have a great day. Enjoy your basketball practice.
I was just going to say, we've got our overnight midnight madness tonight. So practice starts from 7 to 9, and then from 9 o'clock tonight till 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, it's a gym full of a whole bunch of young men who are going to spend the night there and soak up as much basketball fun as they can. And next week we get into the discipline and the structure of basketball practice again.
All right. Well, if you need me to come and talk about investing your assets like fowls, let me know. I'll show up there. I looked at the Montana weather forecast. I'm going to go get some suntan lotion and hang out on the bank of the river fishing for the next week or something.
All right.
Maybe an elk or deer will walk by. But
probably not in that weather. They'll probably hold up somewhere in the shade.
Probably. But, well, folks, thanks for being here. Really appreciate all of you who listen and keep sending us the emails. They're great material for us to come up with ideas. And like Corey said, for all of those who are veterans who have served and are serving, our deepest gratitude to all of you.